Welcome to the 36 Res Ed podcast, produced by Media Snackers with Global Kids. We've got an interview with Thomas Malaby, the author of Making Virtual Worlds, Linden Lab and Second Life, plus an in-dialogue session with Luann Phillips of the National Extension Initiative and Ron Fester of the Division of Continuous Education and Outreach. As ever, let's go over to the Global Kids guys with the news.
Hey everyone, this is Amira.
And this is Krista.
And we're here for your July 6th ResEd News update. First off, ResEd Conference was a huge success. It happened just a couple weeks ago at the Games, Learning, and Society Conference in Madison, Wisconsin. About 45 people gathered for this first ever ResEd Conference. It was an official mini-conference of GLS where attendees participated in not only ResEd sessions and gatherings, but they also gained full access to the always remarkable GLS agenda. We had sessions with luminaries like Robin Harper, James Paul G., Peggy Sheehy, and a lot of discussions for really great small group discussions, networking opportunities, and the sharing of best practices amongst practitioners. The conversation has not ended. We're continuing to post video, audio, and PowerPoints, as well as presentations, all in the ResEd conference group at resed.org. So stay tuned there. Check it out as we continue to update that. And all of our planning for future events will also take place on the ResEd site. So if you would like to be involved in the next either virtual or in-person event, make sure you continue to visit the site regularly as we get your feedback on how to kind of cater the next event.
And next for news, the analyst firm Next Step Research has recently published an extensive report on Linden Lab called Does Anybody Still Use Second Life? And if so, how much is it worth today? The report gives the valuation of Linden Lab between $658 million and $700 million. Highlights from the article are that users are very active in Second Life, and in fact, an average amount of time spent has increasingly been steady and is currently at historic highs, totaling approximately 124 million hours in the first quarter of this year. The negative impact of Second Life is that the aging population of its main target markets, the U.S. and Europe, have less of a presence in developing nations, where its main target audience, people aged 13 to 45, is quickly gaining in size. Also, one of the negative impacts is the cost and complexity of running the technical infrastructure behind the virtual worlds. So, if you'd like to see this article more in depth, please go to resed.org.
And that's it for this week's news. If you have news that you'd like featured on the ResEd homepage or on upcoming podcasts, please email those over to resedinfo@globalkids.org.
This is Barry Joseph, and I'm standing here with Thomas M. Malaby, the author of the new Making Virtual Worlds, Linden Lab and Second Life. Thomas is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and ResEd podcast listeners might remember hearing Thomas talking about some of these issues last year at the GLS podcast that we did, telling us that around now we could watch out for his book. So we're really excited that he's here today to talk with us about it on the day just before, just after it was released.
Yes, just coming out right now. It's almost impossible for me to keep up with whether Amazon has flipped from the pre-order to the available. But thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. By the time you hear this, it will be available on Amazon.
That's for sure.
So, Thomas, tell us what you did to make this book.
I spent all of 2005 and a little bit at either end at Linden Lab, often there, sometimes virtually there, trying to understand how they work. How they organize themselves as a company, what kinds of values inform how they run themselves as a company, and also what kinds of values inform their architecting of Second Life, how those got written into the world. So the book is about how in making virtual worlds, making this virtual world, they also made themselves almost as a virtual world. They're very parallel kinds of organizations, at least they were at that time, and there's lots of feedback from one to the other.
And when you say values written to the world, can you say a little bit more about what that means?
Yes. Linden Lab is really situated historically. That's one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is place where they're coming from against a particular history in the United States that traces itself back to post-World War II ideas about technology and authority and the faith in a bunch of individuals in aggregate with access to technology doing cool things. That's actually a rather peculiar notion in lots of ways. It presupposes a particular notion of the human that, to great surprise to me in doing the work, that is not very social. It's a picture of the human that sees people as gamers of a sort, of a particular sort, looking to master a complex system. And in a way, Second Life was built as a complex system, almost a game engine without the game content, that all of its users would seek to master and seek to express themselves through creatively and create shared experiences for other people. But a lot of social things like senses of belonging and grouping and exclusion and politics and gossip, all of those things took Linden Lab a bit by surprise. It was never really part of their picture of what people were all about.
So where does that leave Second Life as a space for educators to think about doing the work that they do, both as a place that was designed with certain values and yet other properties emerged over time?
I think it's very important for anyone trying to do work in Second Life to understand what the architecture is doing for them and what the architecture, in what ways it's working against them. I think Second Life is built to work against certain kinds of sociability and certain kinds of collective action. I remember one of the earliest pieces I wrote about Second Life was about the concept of content around Linden Lab. And even while I was there, you could hear Linden Lab employees struggle to remember that content included things that weren't scripted, built, or texture mapped. It included things like meeting groups and the like. That was a struggle for them. And that's because they're coming at making this world from a particular perspective that thinks all you would need to make anything are these content development tools, effectively. So I think educators, when they're trying to make things in Second Life, they have to understand that the tools have a certain bias to them. They are about making game content. So workarounds are very important to try and bring those social elements in, to value the social, to value the collaborative, to value belonging and feelings about identity that, in some ways, Second Life wasn't built to prompt or to encourage.
And when I think you finished working on the book, or rather finished your time at Linden Lab, they had grown tremendously at the time, but at that point it was only, what, about 120,000 avatars?
That's right. When I started, it was about 11,000 people who had ever created an account, and when I finished, 120,000 people. It was a year that, for them, you could feel it around Linden Lab. There was this kind of wait-and-see feeling about that year and whether this was really going to take off after all the changes they had made.
And now there must be, what, somewhere over 12 million, something like that?
Right. Now it's a completely different level.
So the whole virtual scene has changed tremendously since you were last at Linden Lab, and there are many options for educators who want to use virtual worlds. Is there anything you can recommend for folks from the perspective put forth in this book and the lessons that you're sharing with us today that educators should be keeping in mind as they think about where they should be taking their young people in virtual worlds to do educational programs?
I think it's just one of those features of technology and the development of technology that early technologies can sometimes be a bit hamstrung by some of the initial assumptions they make. So that a lot of the new things that are coming onto the scene, MetaPlace, Small World, those kinds of newer virtual worlds, can kind of look afresh at what's available, what they can connect with, what they can let their users do, and maybe be a little less driven by a particular notion of virtual world participation as game content development, and instead involve the social, involve the rise of the social networking sites we've seen, other knowledge information sites that are out there in more effective ways, more integrated ways.
Thomas, thank you so much for speaking to the Res Ed community today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Barry Joseph from Global Kids, and welcome to the latest Res Ed in Dialogue. I'm joined today by Luann Phillips and Ron Festa. Luann Phillips, also known as Think a Little in Second Life, works with the National Extension Initiative as their Virtual Worlds Coordinator. And Ron Festa is the Virtuals Administrator for the Division of Continuous Education and Outreach at Rutgers University. And as you might have noticed, they both have Virtual Worlds in their title. That's something we'll be looking at today. Welcome to us. Welcome to you both to Res Ed.
Thank you very much, Barry.
Now, we all met each other at the recent State of Play conference here in New York City. Its subtitle was Plateau, suggesting that is the current state of virtual worlds after having a lot of attention in the media and a lot of interest in the business world. But I'm wondering, you're both embedded in the world of education, and I'm wondering if that title resonated for you, and if so, why, and if not, why not? Luann, would you start, please?
Sure. You know, I started in virtual worlds with great enthusiasm about the potential within the education field. I think we're still looking around for the best models, the best practices, the aha things that are going to propel it forward into the mainstream. So in that sense, perhaps it is a little bit plateaued, although I'm still here, which is a good thing.
Well, so let me go back to you, Luann, and ask you, what is the National Extension Initiative, and what does it mean to be their virtual worlds coordinator?
Well, to understand what that is, you need to understand the cooperative extension system, which has its roots back in the 1800s. It's a model of non-formal education delivery that was designed to help farmers learn how to grow their crops better back in the agricultural society that existed at that time. Since then, the mission has broadened to include more than purely agriculture, but it's still a fairly conservative rural-based organization, and for it to be exploring in virtual worlds at all is pretty remarkable. The traditional mode of delivery for education is to have knowledge from the land-grant university system transmitted down to the community level by a system of about 15,000 educators that range from PhD level educators at the university down to community-based educators in county offices throughout the United States. And normally this is done through face-to-face interaction, say at a farm, or by mailing a pamphlet about a particular issue out in response to a question, or having classes, small classes. So for the National Extension Initiative is trying to infuse all sorts of web technologies into this process to create new ways to deliver this educational model in a more 21st century way. In virtual worlds, we're looking at new ways to do this in a three-dimensional, immersive way to kind of replicate the real world experience in a more cost-effective and broader reaching way.
And how long has this position existed, a virtual world coordinator?
It was actually created because I was willing to take it. I was actually in Second Life and working at the county level in cooperative extension as an educator in youth development with the 4-H program. The cooperative extension system actually administers the largest youth development program in the world, which is the 4-H program. It has about 6.5 million youth ages 5 to 19 who are enrolled. We haven't done a whole lot yet with the 4-H program in virtual worlds because I began with the adult perspective first, although we do have an island in Teen Second Life that's available for 4-H educators to experiment with if they wish to. So anyway, that was about a year and a half ago that I got started with the National Extension Initiative as their virtual worlds coordinator when they launched their website and their official presence as an entity. They had me build a virtual state fair in Second Life so that we could have a mixed reality nice. Event associated with their launch, which was in Washington, D.C.
So in other words, it might be like measuring the largest pig in Second Life or...
What kind of things would we do in Second Life? Well, actually, right now we have a number of projects. We have, let's see, what's the list right now? Soil science, integrated pest management. There's an assistive technology house, a food safety diner where you can identify the food safety hazards. There's a sod ball that shows different kinds of turf grass.
Nice.
There's a laundromat where we hold classes on clothing care. The next class is on July 20th. And the Dare to Be You program of the Colorado State 4-H program is working on our Bailey Island in Teen Second Life on a life board game. So that's just some of the things we're working on right now.
Well, thank you, Luann. And I personally love state fairs, so I love them in person, and I'd love to experience one virtually as well.
It's the iconic symbol of the cooperative extension system, yeah. Really.
Nice. So, Ron, how long have you been with Rutgers?
I've been with Rutgers a little over 2 years now. As for like my job title being a virtual worlds administrator, I would say that's been about a year and a half. Believe it or not, I actually kind of fell into this position here at Rutgers because I originally started off in the regular IT department on repairing computers and stuff for different sections we work with. I'm sorry.
No, go on, please.
Pretty much this whole thing with the virtual worlds at the Division of Continuous Education is pretty much the brainchild of Dr. Ricaprio, and it was literally by chance that I was able to get meet him, and he showed me what they were originally doing. And because I had a few years experience prior with Second Life, I was able to turn around and revamp the whole thing to be a fully functional and usable state. One of the things we did was we managed to completely recreate Old Queens, which is the first Rutgers campus. Gone so much into detail, you could actually go in and ring the bell.
Nice. So I understand that you have developed, or Rutgers rather has developed, a class for students to take to learn virtual worlds before they can actually go into a class that uses virtual worlds for some other topic. Is that correct? And if so, can you say more about how that developed and why?
Actually, it's more of an in-development thing right now.
Okay.
We are working on creating a workshop for professors to get them used to Second Life and virtual worlds. And after that, we are going to set up the class for the students to be able to take, because we need the professors ready before the students than anything else. The reason why we did that is because I recognized immediate problem that we were having. And that was that originally we were expecting, you know, for us to show this off, provide the materials and stuff for professors to use, but it was like all this was brought to my attention that we were pretty much throwing them into the deep end. And that's when me and the rest of our cooperation group got together and said, hey, we really need to create, you know, a workshop for professors and our senior staff. Rich Novak and Dr. Caprio came up with the concept of having the workshop and the 1.5 credit course for both students and professors alike. This way, everyone's up to speed before they even go in to these classes that use Second Life. Because, I mean, you saw it yourself when we were talking amongst those professors during our Birds of a Feather meeting at the State of Play conference. A lot of these professors were wasting so much time with the class, just getting students accustomed to virtual worlds, that very little was getting done. And that is why we're doing this.
And that'll be like a 1.5 credit course or something like that?
Yes, for students it would be a 1.5 credit course. Obviously, you know, it makes sense to have it as a paid-for course because you still need like math to get into physics and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to have a regular course offering for students to be able to get into the classes that are using Second Life.
Thank you, Ron. Now, Luann, how do you guys deal with the learning curve required to support educators and students to be using virtual worlds?
I think this is a really interesting idea that that Ron has. Actually, each state has a land-grant university that is part of the cooperative extension system, and Rutgers happens to be the land-grant university for the state of New Jersey. So I'm very interested in this experiment of his to try to develop a curriculum that's available to students and faculty to orient them to Second Life. We tried earlier this year to run 6 sessions of a freshman soil science class from University of Nebraska-Lincoln in Second Life, and there was really no lengthy orientation for the faculty. They came in and actually helped us design the classroom experience without really understanding Second Life very well, which makes it hard for them to understand what the possibles are. So, you know, they would have liked certain things to happen in Second Life, but you know there are limitations to the interface, and they really didn't understand both the capabilities and the limitations as they were designing the experience for the students. And also when the students entered the class, they were allowed about 20 minutes to become oriented to Second Life, which wasn't really enough for the 2-hour experience of the class that we had planned. They spent a lot of time during the class period doing things like riding the dog that was on the farm and you know, talking with each other and making themselves fat and thin, you know, just that silly stuff everybody does when they first get into Second Life. So I think it would be really great to have a specific time allotted for that, maybe even a course for credit that Ron has come up with, so that people come to Second Life ready to work on the task at hand and with all that already taken care of. They look good. We prepared pre-made avatars for the students, which helped a lot, so they didn't have to dress themselves and all that. But still, it was not the first half hour experience was not optimized.
And did you have to develop your own curriculum from scratch, or did you pull on existing web-based resources that other educators might want to know about?
No, they designed this from scratch, and actually we proved what not to do in Second Life. They now have a National Science Foundation grant in to do the class in a much more Second Life-friendly way. It turned out that what their vision was to have the students go around and collect text-based documents about a soil science problem that they were to solve, which meant they were pulling up documents that were texture files that had charts and graphs about the soil profiles and the well contamination and that sort of thing. And the control group was using the documents in real life already printed out on paper. So there really was no advantage to collecting the documents in Second Life and then reading them, because it was much easier to do that in the classroom off a piece of paper. That said, the students' feedback was that what they really wanted was to have an actual farmer in Second Life that they could engage with and talk to about. It happened to be an herbicide over-application on a cornfield, and they thought if they actually had a corn farmer there and maybe a cooperative extension soil scientist there that they could question about the problem, it would have been a much richer experience and would have made more sense to them. So the new curriculum design has included these actors, which aren't really going to be actors there. We considered using scripted bots, but we decided that it would really be better to have an actual farmer with an avatar and an actual soil scientist with an avatar participate in the classroom experience to make it more realistic. The purpose of this was to give them the experience, a simulation of the experience of going out and actually working as an extension agent solving a problem for a farmer at a farm without actually going physically to a farm.
Yeah, it's always important for us to share both the best practices of what works, but also the stuff that doesn't work, because this is a new space for many of us.
Yeah, and it's okay to make mistakes, because we're all learning, sure.
That's right. Now, you've both talked about Second Life. I'm wondering if you guys are using or considering using any other worlds beyond Second Life, and if not, why you guys have landed on Second Life to meet all the current needs for your organizations.
The reason why we chose Second Life right now is because right now it's currently the most mature of the virtual worlds platforms that we could use, where we have almost complete control over the environment. We do keep our minds open to other alternatives, such as OpenSim. I'm not a big fan of OpenSim because it is still very premature. It's great for prototyping our stuff, but not for actual production use. Another one we're keeping an eye on, but I'm very skeptical about, is Blue Mars. I know we didn't get a chance to really talk about that too much at State of Play, but Blue Mars is, as much as they want to claim it's a beta, it is very much an alpha, and is nowhere near ready for what we want to do. So right now, Second Life is in my opinion, the best platform to use for college-level students.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ron.
Yeah, I would agree with that somewhat. We're looking at Blue Mars, Open Cobalt, OpenSim. I'm even looking at MetaPlace after having Raph Koster there at State of Play and explaining a little bit more about what it can do. Although, for our purposes, a more realistic version of the subject matter is probably more important to us than it might be for some people. So MetaPlace doesn't really have the look that we need. But I like the fact that that anybody can create content in Second Life, albeit a little bit primitive. You know, anyone can go in there and learn to use the tools. Co-creation is possible, collaboration that's not possible in an environment where only professional developers are allowed to create content. So I think we'll be in Second Life for quite a while. We do have a bit of a problem with Teen Second Life, with the limitations both of age and also the difficulty of facilitating adult youth interaction, since that's the basis of the 4-H program. So we may be looking at other youth worlds that are a little easier to work with a broader age range.
Honestly, I wouldn't worry about the age thing too much longer with the problems with the teen grid, because One of the, I'm not sure if you've seen it or not, but Linden Labs is actually working on creating an adult-only continent, and they're really trying to push all the adult material over there. And the reason why is because there's a lot of rumors flying around that they're getting ready to merge the teen grid into the main grid because of all the problems they have with the teen grid.
Well, that's like probably another podcast subject, but yeah.
And definitely yeah, something we all want to keep an eye on. I'm sorry, Luann?
Definitely. The 4-H program ranges in age from 5 to 19, so I'm really looking for an environment where I can include that entire age range, which I don't see Second Life doing anytime soon. I think 13 is going to be their bottom level for a while, at least.
That's a good point. Luann and Ron, thank you so much for joining the Res Ed community today.
Thank you for having us, Barry.
All right, everyone, for your events calendar, upcoming.
There's an upcoming Virtual Worlds Conference at the University of Kansas. This conference is being organized by the Greenbush Southeast Kansas Education Service Center and is intended for Virtual World educators. The event is to be held on July 27th in Kansas City. The goal of the conference is to showcase virtual world technology for education and to share best practices. So stay tuned to the network. You can check it out at vweducation.ning.com for further details. Or as always, you can check out the calendar at resed.org.
And last, looking ahead to September 2nd through 4th, looks like a really fascinating event going on at the University of Arts in London. It's called Designs on E-Learning 2009. They're doing a call for papers right now. It was a very successful conference in 2005 where technology for teaching and learning and arts, design, communication, design, all of these amazing things all coming together under one roof. The conference aims to cast light on established practice in the field, on innovations in teaching and learning with technology, on the challenges and successes presented by the visual nature of our discipline, and on the benefits of online and blended learning. Conference themes are not limited to, but include serious gaming and virtual worlds in education, virtual learning environments in art, design, communication, the social and educational interface, and innovations in teaching and learning in art, design, and communication. All of the lists of themes, registration, and online submission are at designsonlearning.net, or you can check out resed.org for all of the information and details on how you can submit to the request for papers. That's it for this week's events. If you want anything highlighted on the upcoming news and events portion of the podcast, go ahead and send that over to resedinfo@globalkids.org or highlight that on the events listing calendar on resed.org. Thanks, everyone, and have a great week.
All the links referenced in this podcast, as well as the full transcripts, will be available on the show notes at resed.org.